Hi, folks. This is Jack Spierko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is Thursday, May 22nd, 2025. That means it is time for an expert counsel show of the week. And what we got this week is a really good lineup for you. We got Dr. Paul and Dan McAdams. They're talking about the Golden Dome that's part of the Big Beautiful Bill. I'm actually going to talk about the Big Beautiful Bill today. Not the Golden Dome part, since they're going to talk about it. Basically, they're saying, hey, maybe instead of spending all this money on a giant missile defense system, we could just, like, stop pissing off other countries. It's a unique idea, I know. Matt Sersley will talk about how federal disaster areas and responses affect your taxes, something a lot of people don't know about. And if you're unfortunate enough to be involved in a federal declared disaster and in the disaster declared zone, that is bad, but you know, you might as well make the best you can of it, and there are some tax advantages there. What about shooting in low light with an AR, specifically as a new shooter doing some training, indoor training that is? Mike Melito will talk about that. Or what if you wanted to choose productive plants for wildlife in harsh climates, and you wanted to do it with native species, or at least based on native species? This particular is in Wyoming. Ben Falk will talk about that. I actually had Nick Ferguson answer this question as well, but we'll have him answer at a different time. We'll have him do that maybe next week. Then we have from Patrick Worman, thoughts on chainsaw mills and choosing the right saw to go with them. And then Chef Ken Daniels will continue his seafood soup stew series. Today we're going to have episode 2, Chipino. Chipino is one of my favorite things in the world. I discovered it a couple of years ago on a trip to California where it was born. Not everything in California is bad, and Chipino is one of the things that's good. When you hear Chef Ken talk about making it, I have a little add-on for you if you're struggling with a good fish stock or seafood stock, a little quick way you can make a pretty damn good one fast. And then I'm going to talk about, like I said, what's in the Big Beautiful Bill. Now, I'm not calling that because I think it's beautiful, because, well, I don't. It's not beautiful. Big bills are never beautiful. This has some stuff in it that's not all bad, though, and some surprise good. And so when people say, well, they're spending $20 trillion we don't have yet, and that's because it's the day that ends in Y, that's going to happen anyway. I'm pretty big on the concept, and I try to drive this home to people all the time. You should worry about less about the way things should be and more about the way things are, because when you focus on the way things are, then you can clearly see the opportunities that are within the way things are. And then you can capitalize on those opportunities and, you know, make your life better instead of just being mad and yelling at the world because, well, gee, not everybody's a libertarian. And I hate to break it to you, it's not just not all the politicians are libertarians. It's most people aren't. I know we want to believe that most people would be libertarians if they just really understood what it meant. The answer, I'm sorry to tell you, is no, they wouldn't. They just wouldn't. Most people want someone else to pay for their shit. And that's all it comes down to. When you look at both sides, it's all about welfare programs. It's just what kind of welfare and who's paying for what. That's what everybody disagrees with. We're not going to change that anytime soon, but what we can do is understand what benefits us and how to structure our lives so that we maximize the things that benefit us and insulate ourselves from the things that do not, the things that are either harmful to us or even neutral to us. At least we need to know about what they are and how to keep them neutral if they are currently neutral. And there's a big surprise for some people in the Big Beautiful Bill, one I don't think they ever thought that they would get, at least not this way. And we may not get any of the stuff that I'm going to talk about. I'll preface it with that right out of the gate. You see, there's a problem with bills. Just because they have something in them when they pass one side of Congress doesn't mean they will by the time they get done on the other side, and then they go back and have, you know, a resolution series between each other and hammer out the final details and everybody agrees and comes to consensus. This is going to pass, but it doesn't mean it's going to pass the way that it's currently written. But there's some stuff in it that if anything, you'd want them to make it a little stronger, not weaker. And there's some actual limits in the bill on presidential and executive agency power that's very originalist, very constitutionalist, in a very good way. Yeah, not everything in there is bad. Of course, a lot of times you put good things in to sell people on the bill, and that way you get to do your bad. So we'll talk about it, good and bad and ugly. I've got seven specific sections, seven specific categories to go over with you today when we get to my segment. With that, before we do, let me tell you about today's item of the day up front instead of at the end. Yesterday we had the Vivor rechargeable LED headlamp 2-pack. That's a great deal, by the way, guys. It's totally worth picking up several of those at $18 a 2-pack. Like two of them is four headlamps. Rechargeable, bright, but that's not today's item. They have today on sale something I brought y'all before. It's a 24 by 36 dimension top table. It's a stainless steel table with casters, very good casters, mind you, on it. I love this thing. It's become kind of my barbecue accessory table. So I have multiple grills and things like that. So what's nice about it is I can easily wheel it around. Right now it's living between my new pellet smoker and my flat top. But if I'm using my big Weber or I'm using my broiler or anything like that, I can just wheel it around and I have all my stuff there with it. But there's a thousand uses for this thing. It'd be a good movable, like temporary kitchen island, especially for people in smaller places or apartments. Great in a shop. And they're on sale today for, I think, $86. I'm not sure what the stainless steel would cost you if you just went out and bought the steel the damn thing's made out of, but I'm thinking somewhere around $40 just in the value of the steel. So the steel is a steal today. Check it out again. It's by Bavor. You'll find it at thesurvivalpodcast.com. Just scroll down or check today's show notes. There's all kinds of good, yummy links in there. With that, let's go ahead and hear from Dr. Paul and Dan McAdams on the Golden Dome.
Well, it's almost a little bit coincidental, maybe, that just as the Ukraine war may be winding down, Ukraine having bled itself completely dry in its proxy war between Russia and the U.S., now here comes another new massive military boondoggle. And the down payment, of course, is this $175 billion. Now, Trump is claiming that this will pay for it. This is not even going to pay for studies. Put that first clip up. This is from the Epoch Times by way of Zero Hedge. The DOD has selected a design for President Donald Trump's Golden Dome Missile Defense Initiative that Trump announced it on May 20th. I'm pleased to announce we have officially selected the architecture for the state-of-the-art system, next-generation technologies across land, sea, and space, including space-based sensors and interceptors. It does sound like an updated Star Wars. Now go to the next one. It would be fully operational before the end of my term. That sounds a little bit like the jab. So we'll have it done in about 3 years. That I think, Dr. Paul, the chance of that happening is zero. he said the plan of the DOD has selected should cost about $175 billion to complete. Now, we didn't just fall off the turnip truck, Dr. Paul, when we look at them saying, oh, it's only going to cost $175 billion. We know you're going to have to add probably another zero to that at least.
Yes, and it isn't just like you come up with $175 and you have to take it out of somebody's pocket and it's paid off. It just adds to the debt. Then how long is that debt going to be? Well, it will continue forever until the whole system closes. So it's not even the $175. It's the accumulated interest I saw today, you know, which we expected. Interest rates are going up. And people will buy the Treasury bills and pay the extra interest. So it's a lot more than $175 billion. And the odds of it being successful are pretty slim.
First of all, this is a defense against ballistic missiles, hypersonic even, who knows. But the thing that we've learned, I think, from the Ukraine war is that warfare itself is changing dramatically. You know, this is the first war that has become a drone war. These aren't like big missiles, like big Soviet ICBMs coming over and we knock them out of the sky. The war itself has changed. So who's to say between now and $175 billion later, if they build it for that, which we know they won't, it'll be in the trillions. By the time they have it deployed, the whole The whole way that warfare is done may change. It may be lasers. It may be all sorts of things that we don't know now. We're building a massive monstrosity that basically has its ideological roots in the past, in the Cold War, in a world that no longer exists.
Probably a cheaper Golden Dome would be just to stop irritating other countries. You know, then they won't want to shoot missiles at us. Oh, no, no, no. They hate us because of our freedom. That's why they wanted to. It really
I
is.
I remember that story. Yeah.
So I agree, it's going to cost way more than they say, and then there'll be the ongoing cost of keeping it operational, and who knows, it'll probably be one of those things that never actually gets completely done, and it'll be a grift thing. But if it actually does what they say it's capable of doing, since we're not going to piss people off, there's probably worse ways to spend our money. Not that this is a good way, but maybe there are worse ways to spend our money. It may also have the problem of emboldening us to believe that it's better than it is and that we have zero risk where we have significant risk still, and it may embolden some future president or government in some way that's not great. So I don't know. What I've got to talk about that's in the bill is a hell of a lot better than that, most of it anyway. Let's move on and hear from Matt Sersley on how disasters and the actions of the federal government in disaster areas can impact your taxes. This is not the way you want to reduce your tax footprint, but if it is, then so be it.
Hey, TSP, this is Matthew Sersley of AgoristTaxAdvice.com, here to talk to you about more tax tips. Hopefully, these are going to be tax tips none of you need to use, because today I'm talking about how federal disaster zones can affect your taxes. There's a lot of ways, and honestly, I found some new things I didn't know about doing some research for this. Firstly, and most importantly, if you live in a federal disaster zone, it's pretty common to get a filing extension. Sometimes it's a few months, but people from the hurricane that hit North Carolina last year have until, I believe, May 15th of 2025 to file their taxes if they had asked for an extension already. So that's about a 7-month extension. If you have property that was damaged and you get insurance money to compensate you, that insurance compensation, like all insurance compensation pretty much, is tax-free. If it's not covered by insurance, you can claim a loss for the value of the property you lost. Even more importantly, you can claim it a year early. So if you are somebody, unfortunately, who lost property in the California fires this year in 2025, when you file your 2024 taxes in April of this year, you can claim that loss in 2024 instead of waiting until 2025. If you have a business, you can write off any losses for things like destroyed inventory equipment, the cleanup costs, or the repairs. If you're in a federal disaster zone and you need to take money out of an IRA or a 401k, there are ways to do that where you can avoid the 10% early withdrawal penalty if you're not yet 59 and a half. You're typically still going to owe taxes on it if you would owe taxes anyway, but this avoids the withdrawal penalty. Even better, you can repay the money into your retirement plan. If you do that in the time period allowed, you can avoid the taxes and also get that money back in there faster than maybe you could otherwise. A really cool thing, and this is the one I didn't know about, is a 1033 exchange. So a lot of people in real estate have heard of the 1031 exchange. If your real estate is damaged in a disaster and you sell that property and use the money to buy another similar property, you can avoid all of the capital gains on that sale. Unlike the 1031 exchange, you may have 2, 3, very rarely even 4 years to complete that purchase of a new property. And the way it works is basically you maybe pay the taxes up front, but you'll get that money back when you buy the new property. So if you have I know we have at least one listener who a tornado took out his property on the coast of South Carolina a few years ago. You know, this way, yeah, it sucks that it was destroyed, but when you sell and buy something new, at least you're not going to get hit by capital gains if that property went up in value. If you have any of these losses, you are going to want to work with a CPA or an accountant or an attorney to make sure you get everything that you're entitled to. Most CPAs don't really know much about these things, It's really kind of scary how little some people know about these. And again, even as I've admitted, there were some of these provisions I didn't know about because, frankly, they come up so rarely. If you have questions about this or anything else, please reach out to me at agoristaxadvice.com/TSP. That'll get you onto my email list. We'll get about one email a week from me on various tax tips and also a free download of over 60 different business deductions just to get your mind going on what can I deduct? You know, follow Jack's advice. Let your mind be working in the background subconsciously on what's the best way to work this out. Don't ask, is this deductible? Ask, how can I make this deductible? Well, that's all for this week. Hope to hear from you guys soon and keep saving you guys money and keeping money out of the IRS's hands.
All right, moving on, let's hear from Mike Melito on a question about practicing with an AR and having issues in low light, specifically with irons versus optics.
Well, hello, TSP. We meet again. Michael here from Gunfighter Life Podcast, coming at you today from the mobile studio, not a Volkswagen Jetta, for those of you that listen to the OG Survival Podcast episodes, but rather a Ford F-150 with a Rhodesian Ridgeback riding shotgun. It is spring bear season after all. Although today's episode is not about spring bear hunting, it is about training in indoor shooting range lighting conditions. It's a good question. What attachment or gadget do you recommend for dim indoor practice shooting? Full question. Paraphrasing, so I'm a novice. I'm attending a bi-monthly get-together with a club for some practical shooting at an indoor range. I'm using completely bare Smith & Wesson M&P 1522. Before making any upgrades, I wanted to practice with a minimum learning to use iron sights. I'm getting better, however, I notice a vision limitation. Only when indoors, I seem to struggle focusing my vision on targets. Struggling to focus my eyes on the black outlines or circles. He goes on to say it only happens indoors, and he's hoping I can recommend some things here. So, numero uno, you should never focus on the target if you're shooting iron sights while you're actually shooting. Your hard focus should be on the front sight. The human brain can only focus on one plane at a time, like one distance plane. So focus on the front sight. Maybe that was a mistype on your part, but I get what you're saying. It is rather hard to use peep sights in low light. So let me start with, you said you were new to shooting, so I don't want to insult you, but make sure you're using the O2 rear aperture. O2 stands for 0 to 200 meters. It's also what you use in urban warfare and up close and dirty fighting. I was an urban warfare instructor for the Marine Corps. Anytime you're shooting fast, if you have the option with those rear apertures, the standard is 2. You have the small rear aperture and the flip-up O2. The O2 is what you should be using indoors. You should be using in low light, and it's what you should be using if you're going fast, and speed is important. It lets in more light, which is germane to your situation. I don't know if the M&P 22 has that. If it doesn't, just get one. Magpul, and I'm not sponsored by any of these companies I'm going to mention. Magpul is kind of a standard good flip-up rear sight, and it has an option for the small aperture and the O2 aperture. The other thing that I'm going to tell you to do, super, super tactical, get some white out and paint the front sight post white, especially if you're shooting black targets. So paint the front of that white. And if you're trying to go real fast and you want to make yourself a caveman EOTech, paint the entire bottom below the front sight post white as well. That way when you throw it up and you're shooting, you can shoot faster, pick up the sights faster, and when you go to focus on the top of the sight, the rest of that will disappear in the aperture. But super tactical white out or white fingernail polish. So those are both easy fixes there. The other thing I'm going to recommend is a different front sight post. Meprolite makes a good night sight for your front post. It uses tritium. It's $34.99 on Midway USA as I'm looking at it right now. And it glows with radiation so you can see it in the dark. The other one I'm going to recommend is Mounting Solutions Match Front Sight. That's fiber optic. That one's $51. It uses fiber optic pipe to gather ambient light and focus it in the center of that front sight post. Either one of those would work okay. And I do want to say I applaud you for learning to use iron sights, and I applaud you for taking your responsibility of being well-regulated seriously and getting out and actually training. I appreciate that. I'm sure Jack and many others in the audience do as well. So I just wanted to say that right off the bat. And I'm glad you're learning to shoot iron sights. However, once you're good with iron sights, red dots and magnified optics are a force multiplier. And there's a big debate on LPVO, low power variable optic, versus a red dot. I tend to prefer LPVOs, to be honest, but for what you're doing with a 22 indoors, it kind of screams red dot to me. Red dot sight is just kind of a term for a bright illuminated dot or other shape that is projected inside an optic. They can be green, they could be other colors, but generally they're referred to as red dot sights. There are a myriad of red dot sights on the market. I'm going to name three. These are not the only three. But the Bushnell TRS-25 red dot sight, again on Midway because that's just where I looked it up, $79.95. I've used one of these for years on a 22. Is it the greatest sight? No. But is it sufficient for what you want to do? Yes. Will it work for $80? You know, Bushnell, they're kind of a low end on the optics, but they make decent stuff, especially for a 22 and indoor training. So if you want the most affordable recommendation I'm going to give you, that's the one. And that's, again, the Bushnell TRS-25. The next one, if you want to go American, Leupold Freedom RDS Red Dot Sight. It is $299.99, again on Midway. It's American-made. Leupold's an American company. Anything I think they have with a reticle is made in America. Leupold RDS Red Dot Sight, $299.99. Made in America. If you want like a really good optic on there, and American-made, there you go. The last one, and I hate to admit it, these are really good. They are made in China, but that's the Holosun ARO Red Dot Sight. These are somewhere in the middle in price. Again, same Midway USA, $149 to $189. And that's the Holosun ARO Red Dot Sight. So they're right in the middle. They're probably, honestly, your best value. Not the cheapest that'll work, but the best value. They are made in China, but I'm not going to lie, Holosun makes some decent stuff. Now, I know you said you need a gun, so I just want to mention that the AR, you're going to need a taller height over bore than many conventional guns. Like if you were mounting it on a Ruger 10/22 or on a shotgun, you're going to want that higher mount. All the ones that I mentioned have the appropriate mount height for an AR-15. But if you're going to go with something else, another red dot, just make sure it has the appropriate mounting height so you can co-witness with your iron sights. When you get it, you mount it. Your iron sights, it sounds like, are already zeroed. So just float the top of that red dot on the top of that front sight, and you should be pretty good with zero. Always confirm it, but you co-witness your iron sights. Make sure you get your appropriate height. Do not forget the trifecta of optics mounting, blue Loctite, a torque wrench, and a silver Sharpie for your witness marks. Before I sign off, just before anybody has a keyboard conniption, I'm not recommending these for your, you know, go play in the sandbox, trade hot rocks with terrorist optics. I'm recommending these for 22s and indoor training. Hats off to all you guys out there actually getting out and training. Thanks, Jack. Thanks, TSP. Have a blessed day.
So I'm going to add one thing that I expected him to add, and he may have just overlooked this because I know he knows what I'm about to say, but given his background and being a kind of a professional instructor, he may just may not have encountered how many people actually have this issue. When you're shooting an AR, military M4, back in my old ass days, an M16A1, right? It is different than just about any shooting platform you've ever used, and specifically when doing so with the iron sights on it. You have a rear aperture that's basically a ring, and yes, you want to use the larger ring when you are shooting in low light conditions or fast. Everything he said is true about that. But it's a head position. And this person says they're new to guns. And if you have never been trained in the military to shoot this platform with irons, especially, because when you put optics on it, it doesn't quite have to be what I'm about to say. Everything that you're supposed to do, if you've never done it before, feels wrong with your head position. Your nose should literally be touching the charging handle, and it's not going to hurt you. And it makes me think of back when I was in basic training, and the drill sergeant took an M16 and put the buttstock against his balls and fired three shots downrange, in like a, you know, not on a burst, but just like a bang, 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 right? And then he put it on his forehead and did the same thing to get across this gun has no real recoil. It is not going to harm you. Now, I will say this. You need to make damn sure the charging handle is fully returned and locked into position, because it can take off a piece of your lip or your nose, even if you're not in the right head position, if you don't. So that's always a thing. But if you have that thing forward and locked, your nose should, the tip of your nose should touch the charging handle. And what you probably need to do is get a look at what that looks like if you're not familiar with what I'm saying. And I think this might help a lot of people out there. And to understand part of why, and why it has such a big impact on light, the amount of light that you have to make your shot, take your hand and make a circle, you know, whatever diameter it is, you know, like you're making an okay, but you got your thumb and your forefinger making a circle. Hold it about 4 inches from your eye and look across the room at something. Now bring it right up to your eye and see how much more field of view you have. Well, that's also how much light comes through that hole to hit your eye. That's how much gain you get there. And so when you shoot with optics, in many instances, that head position is still valid on an AR, but not always, depending on where the optic is, how far forward it is, what kind of optic it is. But your head probably is going to be farther forward even on an optic-equipped AR, M4, M16 platform. Than it would be on, let's say, a Remington 700 deer rifle. But when it is irons. And I've seen people that can shoot really well without doing it. I'm telling you that they would shoot better if they did it the right way. And it's not my arrogance calling it the right way. It's the United States Army and the United States Marine Corps, who the weapon platform was developed for, that developed the best marksmanship in the world on it for the most people that say that is the right way. There's a lot of people I see shooting ARs in some very, let's just say, funky ways. And they are very good shooters. And that's fine. And that just means that they've adapted to their particular style of shooting or what have you. When the military developed the shooting procedure for this weapon, it did it so that you could put it into somebody's hand, give them a week or two of basic rifle marksmanship, and with iron sights, they could reliably hit a half-man-sized target, waist-to-head-sized target at 250 meters. That is what that was designed to do, and it does it very well. And I will tell you that being new to guns actually might make this easier. Because for me, as a 17-year-old kid who had grown up with a gun in my hand, literally, this was a very foreign thing to me to shoot that way. But what came into my head was my great uncle saying, when you get there, do what they tell you to do the way they tell you to do it, because there's a reason even if you don't understand it. So I shut up and I did what I was told. And I was flat amazed. I mean, flat out amazed. When we were shooting at 250 meter half, you know, waist up targets, and they had the screen sitting next to the drill sergeant, and he was telling you to shoot, and he was showing us on the screen what the group looked like, and to be firing a group, you know, that is about as big as your fist at 250 yards with iron sights, it blew me away. But it was simply by doing exactly what they said. There's more to it than that, but it's the number one thing that I see with ARs, and new shooters especially sometimes, and you shoot a 22 as a trainer. It's a great gun as a trainer, by the way. There is no recoil to concern yourself with at all, and just look it up. You'll see what I mean. Maybe someday we should do a whole show just on what's different about shooting an AR than just really. There's a lot of weapons that are so similar that have been developed over times since I was a soldier that's not really the case, that it's only ARs anymore. But it is the original platform that kind of changed the entire dynamic, in my opinion anyway, of what proper head position is on a weapon. All right, with that, let's go ahead and take another one. This one on choosing plants to grow, productive plants for wildlife in a harsh climate, in this case, Wyoming. I got Ben Falk on this one.
Hey, Jack and all. Ben Falk with Whole Systems Design. Question about what native plants do I recommend for site development, guys in Wyoming, which has no mild or even close to mild climates. It's all pretty harsh and windy and cold to very cold. So I would start by saying if you're limiting yourself to what conventionally is thought of as native out in that bioregion, your list is going to be very short. Even things like apples, wild crab apples, which grow pretty well, at least in the Teton Valley area, and are perhaps one of the biggest, definitely one of the biggest boons to wildlife of all kinds in that area, are not, you know, native in the conventional sense of the term. I mean, they're naturalized, they've been there a while, but they haven't been there before Europeans got there. And I would absolutely put apple in the Malus genus at the top of the list, or near the top of the list, for plants that I would be using in your situation. Buffalo berry comes to mind, Schipperdia, it's been native there for longer than other newer native plants to the area. I would look past that simplistic term in your searching for useful plants, to put it mildly. And I would just be looking at other Zone 4 sites, you know, climate analogs. The shortest list is going to be of nut trees. You know, you have essentially black walnut is probably the largest reliable nut that's going to do it in that area. Castanea, like chestnut's not going to take snow and ice very well, and is also marginally hardy to zone 4 anyway. So you're really limited to oaks, the hardiest oaks, red and some white oak varieties, Quercus alba, bur oak for sure, Quercus macrocarpa, and red oak. Those would be top of the list, along with Juglans nigra, black walnut. You could try, if you're in a very warm microclimate of Wyoming, you could try Carpathian walnut. Probably wouldn't be worth it. You could try shagbark hickory. If you have a great microclimate, you may get that to go. That would be highly valuable. That's about the extent of it, as far as I've worked with very cold, hardy nuts. And they're going to be on the top of your list. For trees, of course, hazelnuts will do it there, and I would definitely plant them for wildlife. But Malus genus would be hard to beat. There's a lot of, like, very hardy plums that do well. They have some value, nothing like the Malus. Seaberry's great, more for people directly than wildlife. Very climate appropriate, especially to wind. Of course, vacciniums, all types of blueberry, Nanking cherry. Honeyberry is basically the world's hardiest fruit within reason, like zone 2 plus. That's a Lonicera. Great for wildlife. Not much wildlife that you'd hunt, but definitely, you know, general wildlife. And pollinators, which you mentioned. Those would be some of them. I would you know, look at your standard like wildlife mixes that are available online for that area, and what, like, hunters, you know, talk to hunters in the area and wildlife biologists and see what animals are utilizing. But I would go way beyond the currently native list, that's for sure, and I would look to sites that are really cold, like ours, or, you know, maybe Paul Wheaton is pretty far north. He's probably in a better microclimate than most of Wyoming, but he's in a pretty cold spot. See what he's been working with, and anyone else in, like, most of Wyoming, Montana, parts of Idaho, pretty much all of North Dakota, and some of Minnesota and northern Wisconsin and northern Michigan as well. Good luck to you.
Next up, let's hear about chainsaw milling from Patrick Rohrman.
Hey guys, this is Patrick with MT Knives coming to you today with today's Expert Council segment of the week. Today's question comes from Michael from Minnesota. He says, what chainsaw considerations should I keep in mind when wanting to try chainsaw board milling? I need to upgrade my chainsaw and eventually try my hand at a chainsaw milling. Beaver has a chainsaw mill kit. Maybe it would be worth reviewing. Obviously, bigger is better, but all I want to do is cut dimensional lumber for projects, not necessarily finishing boards for cabinetry. I have a lot of ash trees to take down, 50cc and higher, electric versus gas, and bar length. Thanks, Michael from Minnesota. My knowledge about chainsaw board milling is very limited. I've seen people do it. I actually purchased a wood miser, have used it some. Typically, my suggestion is buy the best tool that you can afford to buy, and buy the tool that is designed for that job. Chainsaws really weren't designed for milling lumber. However, I do see that they'll do the job, and, you know, it can be done, right? Caveat is you're going to lose a lot of that lumber due to the kerf, the cut of the chainsaw, versus, like, a bandsaw mill. But when you're dealing with free lumber, it's free lumber, right? So you're going to lose more lumber, and then cost. I haven't priced chainsaw mills, but, you know, that's something to take into consideration. As far as the size, how many cc's, electric versus gas, and bar length, obviously, if you're going to use this, it's going to depend on the size of the tree you plan on milling down. My wood miser that I purchased is the smallest one, and I'm not sure what the cut capacity is on it, somewhere around 21, 22 inches. I just cut up a log that was over 30 inches in diameter, and I used my chainsaw to cut it down. Now, if you think about it, you know, with the diameter, 21, 22 inches is the width of board I can cut. So even though it's a 30-inch diameter board, as long as I can come along and just take some of the top off, roll it, you know, you can piece it down and make it work. I have mine just set up on some cinder blocks, and it would have been better to have it on a more permanent foundation. Putting a log that size on it was pretty questionable, and then moving it around. My skid steer will lift, it says 1,600 pound capacity. I know that I have lifted probably 1,800 pounds with it, because I bought a ton of feed for my cattle, and I had to bucket some out of it, but I was able to pick it up mostly full. So, electric versus gas. I've got a Milwaukee chainsaw. I like it. It has got a smaller kerf, which is gonna, you know, is good, but it needs a smaller kerf because the electric doesn't quite have the power that the gas does. But the caveat of that is I've seen testing with electric chainsaws. They will cut right through chaps that are supposed to protect you from a gas chainsaw. Those chaps will bind up the motor and, you know, choke out a gas chainsaw. But with the electric, it just eats right through those chaps. So there's an added danger, I guess, in using electric. They're not going to stop if you got, like, chaps on or something like that. And then bar length, like I said, it's going to depend on the size tree that you're cutting. I think mine is a, I don't know, 18-inch bar, 20-inch bar. And it always seems, there's times where it's nice to have a larger bar. But then, too, if you're, you know, it just depends on what you're doing. So, I don't know how helpful this has been. This is just my experience. I don't have very much experience with chainsaw milling. I did spend the money on a mill that was designed for cutting down logs. And even with that, it has its limitations, right? It's easy to buy more tool than you need. I like to buy more tool than I need a lot of times. So, Michael, thank you for the question. I look forward to seeing what you end up doing, whether, you know, what size chainsaw you get, whether you get gas or electric. Be sure to let me know. Send me some pictures of your projects. I know that my wood miser sat there. took me a while to get it put together. Once I did get it put together, took me a while to actually take the time to cut up some wood. I'm excited to use some of this wood for my property to build some projects and put it to use. It's pretty neat being able to take trees from your own property and cut them up and make them into something useful. My sons have carved spoons and all sorts of things from some of the wood that we've harvested from our property. I've cut up some cedar. I'm saving it for some projects I have in mind. I just cut up some pecan. Today, actually, I just bought some furring strips to space out and stack my lumber so that they can dry properly. So, but it's been a lot of fun. I wish I had more time to play with it. And, you know, wood miser, chainsaw mill. I would look into is, I think Woodland Mills makes a pretty nice mill. If I had it to do over again, I might have gone with that over Wood Miser. My Wood Miser took longer than it was supposed to get here. When it got here, there was some damage to the pallet. My experience with Wood Miser was not the best, but they are a company that's been around for a long time. They make a good product, so I wanted to go with one that was well known, and that's why I chose Wood Miser. Thank you for your questions. If you have a question for me, send it to me, patrick@mtknives.net, and I'd be more than happy to share what knowledge I have and just let you know my take on it. This has been Patrick Rohrman with MT Knives. Have a great day.
So I'll just say my overall experience in talking to people about chainsaw mills is they work. They don't work great. And if you need to make a little bit of lumber here and there with timber, they're probably decent for it. But if you need to make a lot, like your idea is you're going to buy a property and build your house by milling the trees on the property enough to build a house, you probably need a significant step up. And you need to be looking at something like a bandsaw mill and something a little more automated and what have you. My other statement would be, the most important thing in doing this is going to be the horsepower, the raw horsepower, and keeping a chain continuously sharpened. So you want the biggest, baddest motor you can get. Like Patrick said, buy more than you need. And the other thing is, like, this is going to eat chains hard, especially depending on what you're cutting. And, you know, if you're going to do this, you really want to be working with fresh cut wood. When that wood fully seasons and hardens, especially if you're playing around with stuff like I got down here, like live oak, I can't imagine the absolute screaming that saw would do, let's say cutting a slab across 10 foot. It just hurts me to think about it. using a seasoned piece of wood, which I think is what you're supposed to do anyway, is you want to cut the lumber well before that wood is fully seasoned out. That just makes sense anyway, but I'm just saying, reinforcing it there. All right, let's go ahead and hear about making Chipino from Chef Ken Daniels.
Hello all, Chef Ken here, back with part two of our seafood soup series. Last episode we hit up France with a modern take on bouillabaisse, brothy, delicate, saffron-laced, but now we're heading back to the USA. Think San Francisco, 1900s, the wharf, picture a bunch of Italian fishermen hauling in scraps at the end of the day. Whatever they didn't sell, whatever broke, whatever was still wiggling around, they threw it in a pot with garlic, wine, and tomatoes. That's Chipino. It's hearty, it's bold, it's forgiving, and most importantly, it's a red sauce seafood celebration that's easy to make at home, even with frozen seafood. So let's dive in. Now, I know some of you are sweating in this summer heat out there thinking, why is Chef Ken talking about seafood stew in the middle of damn summer? Because this is when I fish. This is when the waters are warm. This is when the fish are biting the most. And the seafood, whether it's something I pull in or I pick up from the market, is super fresh. And you know what I do? I make stock. I build bases. I prep the real deal stuff now when the fish is on hand and the garden ingredients are easily available. And I make all my prep and then I freeze it in quarts and stash it like gold for the fall and winter. Come October, I've got Chipino ready to go. I pull out a container, add fresh shrimp or mussels, and boom, hearty comfort, no prep, no mess. So yeah, I teach this in the summer. It's when the real chefs plan ahead. So what is Chipino? Chipino is the Italian-American answer to bouillabaisse. It's a fish stew born in the San Francisco Bay from the Ligurian immigrants. Liguria, by the way, is a coastal region in northwestern Italy, home to things like pesto, and a cuisine built on olive oil, garlic, herbs, and seafood. It's bright, it's rustic, and it's built around what the ocean gives you. So imagine these guys landing in California, seeing all this Dungeness crab and rockfish and mussels and tomatoes everywhere and saying, you know what? I got an idea. So let's start with the base. That's how we do it. We're going to start with aromatics. So begin with olive oil and butter. Yes, both. Olive oil gives you that Ligurian backbone and butter rounds it out with this soft, creamy texture. Add some chopped fennel, onions, and celery. We're going to add garlic in a little bit, but we want everything else to soften first. I do not want to burn the garlic. So a big tip here is I add a little pinch of chili flakes and about a half teaspoon of fennel seeds for a background heat and an aromatic. It makes for a warm and deeper dish. Step two, I'm going to add a spoon of tomato paste. I throw that in, stir it around, and I let it caramelize. Then I pour in a dry red wine, something that's decent enough to drink. How much? Half a bottle, could be a whole bottle. Really, I wish there was a better answer, but whatever you put in, just make sure you reduce it by half. Once it's reduced by half, then I add canned tomatoes, whole peeled San Marzanos crushed by hand. What are San Marzano tomatoes? They are really fancy, high-quality tomatoes you can find in a can. Really, it does make the dish. Poor-quality canned tomatoes can be watery and like acidic junk. Splurge on the good stuff. So now that that's in, now we're going to add in the stock or the main liquid. And most recipes will say seafood stock. And if you've got seafood stock or you want to learn how to make a good seafood stock, email me at info@bloodsugarchef.com. I can get you a really great recipe. I actually use and have had a great success with clam juice. 1 to 2 quarts. Again, let this simmer with the lid ajar, lower heat, and reduce all this by half. So here's some chef secrets that we normally won't tell you. One, I add some anchovy paste or a splash of fish sauce. No one will actually taste the fishiness. They'll just say that it has an incredible depth of oceanous flavor to it. And at the end, I always tend to do some orange zest or a squeeze of orange juice. It's not citrusy. It just kind of brightens up this liquid. So this is where I stop and freeze a batch for colder months, and then I save some for my dinner tonight. So we've got the base Chipino. Now what seafood goes in? Use what you have, frozen or fresh. Think white fish like cod or halibut, shrimp, scallops, mussels, and crabs if you want to go full San Francisco. I start with the firm fish, cut into 2 by 2 pieces, gently place them in the stock, then scallops, and then the shrimp goes in. I then top my broth with the mussels and crab. Just they'll sit on top, but the steam and flavor will cook them perfectly. Remember, you're poaching, not boiling. Gentle heat, wide pot, no stirring. You don't want to break that fish up. Let them just sit covered on low heat for about 5 to 10 minutes. When you see your mussels open up, you know the dish is ready. So finishing touches, once it's all cooked, I turn the heat off. I let it sit for 5 minutes. Then the flavors just marry together. Lastly, I spoon this into a large bowl, drizzle with finished olive oil, add a bit of fresh herbs like a flat leaf parsley or some basil, and I then grate some orange zest right on top. I serve in a big wide bowls, and if you're not doing bread, fine. But if you are, grilled sourdough rubbed with garlic, it's like San Francisco sourdough was made for this dish. Floated on top, it's simply one of the best dishes in the world to eat. So that's Schipino. It's rustic, it's powerful, but damn easy to make. No cream, no carb bombs, just good seafood, honest broth, and a few tricks from an old chef that loves this dish. What's next? Moqueca. We're going full Brazilian. Coconut milk, lime, coriander, and fire. Bright and bold, but unlike anything you've ever seen. Remember, if you have any questions or just want some damn good recipes, stop by BloodSugarChef.com or DrinkEatLearn.com. Keep those questions coming in. This is Ken, the Blood Sugar Chef. Cheers.
So two quick ads. One for this or anything when it comes to the fish itself, not the shellfish and all. A very overlooked freshwater fish that will substitute beautifully in all of these dishes and many other seafood soups and stews, and a very popular type of fish to use in a lot of Thai and other Asian cooking is catfish. Just saying, you can use it, and catfish is actually beautiful in a soup or a stew because it's a firm enough fish to hold together well. That's just an aside. But the other thing is on the stock, Better Than Bouillon makes a lobster base that makes a freaking excellent quick way to whip up a fish stock or a seafood stock for any of these things. And, you know, it is lobster versus, you know, fish, which they used to make, but it's freaking delicious. And it really works well with any sort of I do Thai curry catfish stew, and I use that in the base, and it just really freaking works nice. Anyway, let's move on, and let's talk about the Big Beautiful Bill. And again, I'm not reinforcing the marketing there. That's what the freaking thing is being called by everybody talking about it. And when I say that, you'll know it. I'm going to say some things that are really good here. And that doesn't mean that I think this is the most wonderful thing that's ever happened. And I want to preface this as I go into it with what I keep saying. Worrying about the way things should be is fine for intellectual exercises. When it comes down to it, though, in the end, we need to worry about the way things are. And then we need to plan for the way things are, and we need to adapt our lives based on the way things are, and we need to capitalize on the way things are. And there's some stuff in here that's going to be really good for a lot of us if we take that mindset. And the policy itself, the taxation policy, is going to put more money in more hands and create more spending, which is going to really significantly boost the economy. Again, that doesn't mean it's going to be great 20 years from now, you know, when we've added another $50 trillion to the debt. But it's what's going to happen in the relative short term of the next 5 years, okay? Let's talk about this, and I have this broken into 7 categories. My first category is middle class tax relief that is temporary. In other words, it has a sunset date in the bill, and it will either have to be redone in 2028 or it will go away. That just happens to coincide with the next election, where you'll probably be looking at the Republicans unless something drastically changes with a nomination for J.D. Vance. The standard deduction will get a temporary bump. It's not huge. It's a few thousand dollars. And all that means is if you're not itemized, they doubled the standard deduction under Trump 1.0. And then they took away the SALT deductions, which that hurt the other side of it. But for most people that are not upper income people and don't live in stupid states like New York and California with very high property taxes, it benefited them. Well, they've now bumped that standard deduction even higher. It will probably save the average person about somewhere between $500 and $1,500 on their taxes. It's $500 to $1,500 you didn't have otherwise. Again, for people that don't itemize, and that has nothing to do with your Schedule C, that's your individual taxes, what you would do on your 1040, not your Schedule C. Tip and overtime pay will be made tax exempt. from 2025 to 2028, so 3 years. So it's not permanent unless it's renewed. Auto loan interest will be deductible from U.S. assembled cars only. That phases out if you're an individual paying tax on more than $100,000. Okay? Doesn't mean that that's your revenue. Again, if you have a business, you understand what I'm saying. But if you have if you're a salaried employee and you're making $110,000, you are not going to be able to do that. So when people say it's all for the rich, well, that's clearly not for the rich guy that's leasing a Lamborghini, okay? If you file joint taxes, though, and you're married, the total amount before it phases out is $200,000. So if you're making like $110,000 and your spouse makes like $60,000 or $70,000, you can still do this. And this will is really going to help what you would consider middle to upper middle class Americans. It is good for that. It's temporary. And then there's going to be this new thing. I just learned about these things. They're really called MAGA accounts. Now they're called Trump Savings Accounts. And this is any child born between January 1, 2026 up to 2028. And there's been some talk of making it retroactive back to 2024. The government will deposit a $1,000 seed into an account for that child the day that they're born. Parents and family combined can add $5,000 a year to it. They don't have to, but they can. And then the money becomes available for use for college once they get into college, or it can be left to continue to draw interest, which is estimated to be around 7-8%. And at 30, the child, who is now a young man, will be required to withdraw, and it will be taxable on it when they get the money as a capital gain. So for most people at that age, will be somewhere between 0-15%. If they're a high income earner at that point, or taxes change a lot, it could be as high as 25-30%. Okay, but that's all temporary, and there's not a thing in there that I'm opposed to, not one thing. Permanent tax changes. The 2017 double standard deduction is made permanent. And permanent as permanent goes with government, right? They can always change it, but they'd have to intentionally change they'd have a new bill. It won't just expire. The estate tax exemption remains so high that almost nobody listening to me should even care, and the kind of people that have more money than that to leave to heirs don't have to worry about it anyway because they're doing everything through trust. If you have that kind of money, you ain't even worried about it either. So basically, the estate tax, which is the death tax, is dead and remains dead. And Trump did that in his first term. The P's limitation on itemized deductions is repealed. You might wonder what P's limitation is. This was a senator or a congressman. I don't remember which. I guess all senators are congressmen. It was a senator or a representative that in the 90s, to get one of the budget deals through, suggested this as an amendment. It was adopted, and what it said is people that made over a certain amount of money, when they did itemized deductions for things like charity and all the stuff that we write off, if they made, I think it was over $500,000 a year, that they couldn't do it, and that's gone. So basically, just treat everybody the same from a tax standpoint with itemized deductions. The SALT deduction cap has been raised to $40,000, indexed to inflation, but it phases out when your income exceeds $500,000. So when they tell you this is for super rich people, that's bullshit. It's not. Now, a guy making $400,000 is doing really, really well, and he's probably the exact kind of person that would have a house that has like $40,000 in property taxes on it. What this is about is that before we doubled the standard deduction under Trump 1.0, you, as one of your deductions on your tax return, could deduct your property taxes and either your state income tax or your state sales tax. And there's I can't remember what they call it now, safe harbor deduction on sales tax if you don't want to keep all your receipts and add them up. My wife would keep all the receipts and add them up, and they drastically exceeded the safe harbor deduction. And when Trump doubled the standard deduction, it ended up not being worth it to do it for us because we exceeded it and the standard deduction was basically higher anyway, so it was less work to get more of our money back. And it also changed the way that we did our home office deduction, because the things that were no longer deductible got backfed through the square footage calculation. So this may not actually be as good for us as it is for a lot of other people, because that was a very unique thing in the way that it helped us to be able to take things like all of the property tax as part of the home office deduction. So one way or another, we can still do this. And this is one of the places where they did have this big fight about it being for super rich people. And I remember saying when we were watching the news, Dorothy and I, all you got to do is put a limit on income on it. That's exactly what they did. So if you make over $500,000 a year, you don't get those SALT deductions. So if they tell you it's for billionaires, they're lying. Regulatory limits and power shifts. The RAINS Act rule, federal regulations that have over $100 million in economic impact now need congressional approval. What does that mean? That means when the President of the United States writes an executive order and directs the EPA to do some bullshit to you, if that action will have a greater than $100 million impact on the economy, which it doesn't take a lot to do that from the federal level, that Congress must approve the rules change. So in other words, the president and these agencies can no longer just write new rules and do whatever they want with the budget that they have. If what they're going to do is going to have an impact on the economy greater than $100 million, then they need congressional approval for it. So it's a serious check on the power of the executive and returns to the Congress their power of the purse that they're supposed to have and never seem to want to use except to spend it. That's a good thing. There is a loophole in it in that, you know, the government decides what the impact is and says, oh, it's only going to be $50 million or anything, something like that. And so there will be court cases over this. But in the end, it's going to drastically reduce the amount of rule writing and new rule implementation at the executive level, which probably isn't something people are hugely concerned right now with Trump. Because what Trump's doing is reducing those things and cutting back. And that's the thing. A president will still be able to rein in these agencies and take rules away. But then when the next president goes to put them back, they're going to have to get congressional approval to be able to do these things with the significant economic impact. And again, that $100 million is impact on the economy as a whole. Like, you create this cascade of events, and then what does that do? It is not how much they're spending. So it's not like, well, when the EPA wants to, they'll just do this one initiative and they'll say we're spending $90 million on it. And we'll do this other one, we're going to do $80 million. See, it's not, no, that will not work. Though they could try to do less at the, you know, and say lessen the impact and do 10 different things, all of which, so that game will be played. You always have to watch for that. But this is good. It's very originalist and it's very constitutionalist. And amazingly, the big dictator wants that in there. That's funny, isn't it? 10-year ban on states enacting AI regulations. This is something, you know, the Liz Warren type people of the world are shrieking about and what have you. There's a lot of people shrieking about it. They don't really give a shit, but there's just something to shriek about. And it's Trump, so we have to shriek. All it basically says is, like, Texas can't have its own rules for AI, which would be stupid anyway. And would create this patchwork of bullshit at a time when the United States needs to be developing AI faster and better than all of our adversaries are. So that, to me, that's a good thing, too. I don't really want anybody regulating anything. So if you restrict the states from regulating something, I'm probably going to be okay with it, especially when you're not regulating it heavily either. The Treasury also can revoke the nonprofit tax-exempt status over terrorism links. So if they think an NGO or a nonprofit college or a charity or anything like that is somehow enabling terrorism, they can remove their tax-exempt status. If that's not abused, that's probably a good thing. I think it should be more like if you're enabling terrorism, you shouldn't exist. But that's also very subject to interpretation. It may be toothless or it may be overtoothed. We really don't know yet because we don't know what it'll look like by the time the Senate's done with it. Healthcare and education reforms, Medicaid changes. This UK, hey, God, Medicare, they're going to take away, and the children are going to die in the street. Shut up. There's work requirements added to Medicaid. If you are on Medicaid, it doesn't necessarily mean there's anything wrong with you. It just means you don't make enough money and your kids get it sometimes, right? They, in Texas, it's called CHIP. States kind of manage their own programs, but the money comes from Medicaid. Sometimes it is for you. Sometimes it is because you're somewhat disabled. But if you are an able-bodied person capable of doing a job receiving Medicaid, you're going to be expected to work and to not be basically committing fraud by not working. Because you start working and you might just find out you don't get no more Medicaid because now you make more money because you actually make money from actually doing a job, and it's going to increase the amount of oversight with that and verification that this person like basically right now you get on Medicaid, no one ever talks to you again. Like, okay, you're on, it's permanent, yeah. Hey, no one's actually checking to see, like, well, did you get better or, like, whatever? Why were you here in the first place? Is the condition still there? There's also going to be some increased copay. It's not very much, but it's something. And, oh, my God, they can't afford it. They're already getting free freaking health care, better than you can buy. So I don't care. And bans on gender care for minors and abortion-related nonprofits. I'm fine with both of those. I don't want to be paying for this stuff anyway, so paying for less of it I'm okay with, especially the gender. There's gender care. There is no gender care for minors. Okay? What there is genital mutilation and hormone mutilation of children. That's what it is. And the government should not be. We shouldn't have it, let alone have taxpayer money fund it. So I'm good with that. It ends federal subsidized student loans. What does that mean? You'll never get to college now. You can't get a student loan. No, the federal government will no longer subsidize student loans, and specifically this is how it is affected. Right now you can borrow lots and lots and lots of money. You can go to school for years and years and years and years, and as long as you keep going to school, you can keep borrowing money, and you accrue no interest on the loan. Under this system, you'll start accruing interest when you get the money. So that will make borrowing money to go to college more expensive, and maybe people will think a little bit more. And the whole college enrollment cliff's coming anyway, and people are shifting, which is actually cool because it introduces workforce Pell Grants for trade programs. In other words, they're going to make it easier to get money to go get a trade that people actually will pay you to use. So there's a renewed focus in the educational funding on getting people to actually gain skill sets instead of degrees in bitterness studies. So I'm okay with that. Is it perfect? No. How about firearms? Yeah, they stuck a gun clause in there. Well, shit, that must be bad. I told you Trump was going to take our guns. No. Suppressors. Right now, if they don't change anything, will be removed both from the National Firearms Act and the Gun Control Act. Suppressors will be moved from both the NFA and the GCA. Now, it could change because it was just the NFA 2 days ago. One of the things that got done to kind of push this thing through at the end was adding complete removal from both. Why does that matter? Well, either way, no tax stamp required anymore for a suppressor. If it is only removed from the NFA, see, the Gun Control Act defined a suppressor as a firearm, which is retarded, and I'm going to tell you that if they take that off, there's a very good chance that a whole movement starts to get this to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court as it sits right now would probably rule that that's untrue, and you cannot say that a tube is a firearm, okay? Because it's not. It has no ability to do anything without a gun that it's attached to. And not all it does then is make the sound less. That's all it does. But the Gun Control Act redefined them as a firearm. It's one of the things that they did in there. And that means that not only do you have to have the tax stamp, you have to fill out the same form that you fill out if you buy a gun. In other words, you wouldn't be able to just order it in the mail willy-nilly like you can actually do now because you're doing the tax stamp and the background checks done that way. Okay? It's weird. But if it stays the way it is, anybody anywhere can start a silencer company, you know, the day after it goes into effect. You understand what I'm saying? You're going to be able to go to any website and say, I want to buy that silencer in that configuration, click a button, and have it shipped to your house in a box if it stays the way it is right now. There is a really decent chance when it gets to the Senate that if it remains in there, right, because this is part of how they got it through the House, there's a lot of people in the House who wanted to do this, and they couldn't get it done as a standalone. So they attached it to a bill that the president's pushing, and it all eyes are on, and everybody wants to get it done, so let's add this rider onto it. But if it goes through as is, then suppressors are just what they always should have been, an accessory. Which means you can buy them. Amazon probably won't sell them, but there'd be no reason you couldn't buy them on Amazon and eBay if they wanted to sell them. All right, now, next up is university. Hey, you like that one, don't you? Yeah, we'll see if they leave it in. University oversight. Number one, higher taxes on large university endowments. They've been paying almost no taxes on the interest generated on these giant endowments. So when you write a check to your alum, as an alum to your college, do you think they take that money and they use it so kids can go to school and they can build new stuff and all that? They put it in a giant slush fund, and the interest that that thing chugs out is the money that they spend. That way they keep growing their endowment. They pay no tax on the money that comes in as the endowment if they're a not-for-profit university, which is a bullshit term. And then they do pay tax on the money that's generated out of there to some degree. Well, that tax bill just went up. So if you want the rich taxed, when you got the universities sitting on $80 billion, $200 billion endowments, and they're chugging money out of them, doing nothing but sitting there looking at the money they were given, that would be the richest rich in the world. With one of the sweetest loopholes in the world choked around their neck now. That's a good thing, right? If you want the rich taxed, if you really mean it when you say that, and when you're talking about really rich, you know, I think when you start measuring your wealth in billions, you qualify. And then it applies the corporate tax rate to the largest ones, which is exactly what they should all pay. So the ones with the really fat endowments now are going to pay the same tax that a corporation would pay on corporate earnings without, like, all the special loopholes that companies like GE get to avoid paying taxes at all. Then we have sunset and performance. I just want to kind of reiterate some things here. Almost all the things that really benefit the middle class will expire after 2028. Except the stuff like the major structural changes to tax regulations and firearms, those are permanent. So the double standard deduction from Trump 1.0 was very good for the middle class, despite what Nancy Pelosi told you about crumbs. And it's amazing she wanted her crumbs back, right? But they were just crumbs. That will be permanent, but the no tax on overtime, the no tax on tips, right? The auto loan deduction. And the one reason that's a really important one to think about is if you're factoring that into your purchase of a vehicle, and this isn't actually going to start, no matter what passes or not, won't start till 2026. So let's say you buy a vehicle in 2026 and the interest on your payments is a tax deduction. Well, in 2028, you've only had the vehicle 2 years. You see the problem. Unless they're going to let you front-load the interest, which I doubt they will because a lot of people trade their vehicles in, you're only going to be able to deduct the interest on that purchase for 2 years, and most people are financing vehicles today 5, 6, even 7 years. So it doesn't mean you just go out and buy yourself a $70,000 pickup truck and then laugh about the tax deduction you get from it. It doesn't work that way. So it's just good to be cognizant of these things that are temporary in there. But all in all, I'd call this a win. But Jack, they're going to spend money we don't have and increase the... They're going to do that anyway. I keep telling you, you got to look at what is and what it is going to be versus what should be and what should going to be. And start thinking about, what does this mean for me? How does this make me wealthier if I take the right actions? Folks, you take these tax cuts, you take the tariff policies and the new trade deals and about $10 trillion of new initiatives by foreign companies and domestic companies combined in the United States that go along with that. You add these tax cuts to it. You add the fact that the Genius Act is going to pass, legitimizing stablecoins. And then you realize that the Bitcoin Strategic Reserve is going to happen, and a lot of the things that are going to make things better for people in the Bitcoin space, the Genius Act has to happen first. Like, I know they lie all the time. Well, first we'll do this, and then we'll do that. In this case, they might be lying, but they're not lying that it has to happen first. They've got to get that done. And until they get that done, they're not going to get anything else done. And I think once this is done, you're going to start see them laying up that strategic reserve. There's going to be a lot of money that they're going to be able to recapitalize here that will make it revenue neutral, as in Trump's EO, which means he doesn't have to go to Congress for it. And so, you know what I'm going to tell you? You need to put some damn money in Bitcoin if you hadn't already. Because that, and it's, I guess it's like up to 111,000 a day. And I was only telling you it was the accumulation trough a couple of years ago when it was at 14. And you didn't listen to me to that. And I was only telling you should do it, you know, back in like 2015 when it was like $5,000. And I was only telling you should do it back in 2013 when it was like $600. So it's not like I haven't said it before. But if you think it's gone parabolic, you just wait when all of this stuff comes together, because the side of this that the people that are upset about it, not the lunatic left, who actually should be in love with this bill, by the way. The Democrats should love this bill. It's all the shit, except for the gun stuff, it's all the stuff they talk about doing all the time and never do, right? It's all the things their voters say they want, but they never actually get it. They just keep voting for it and not getting it, and then saying Trump's a Nazi, right? So the Democrats should love this dadgone bill, even though they don't and they can't, because anything Trump touched has got to be bad. I really think Trump should come out and make a statement about how in favor of breathing air he is, just to see how many on the left will wrap a plastic bag around their face and kill themselves, because they just might. But where the intelligent people, the people like Chris Rossini and Dan McAdams and Ron Paul and Tom Woods and those types of people that are opposed to this, where their right is, they're going to print a shitload more money and further devalue the dollar. I think sometimes maybe what they don't get, though, is that's the plan. The entire way that you go from being an import economy to an export economy is to weaken your currency. Now, I'm not saying we should. I'm saying it's what we're going to do. We don't really have another play with fiat right now. And I believe it's why Trump embraced Bitcoin. Because I don't think people will remember, but Trump was not a Bitcoin fan 5 years ago at all. He hated it. He thought it was terrible. Well, you can have it. I ain't going to take it away from you, but I believe in the good old U.S. dollar. Trump 2.0 comes around. He's a believer in Bitcoin. I believe, you know, that Eric and Don Jr. got through to him, and I also think that he is a smart person when it comes to money, anyway, and he knows how screwed the dollar is, and so the U.S. government has to have a reserve to deal with the restructuring of the currency that eventually has to happen, and I believe the guy's actually looking ahead in a pretty decent way here. A lot, I said this before, and people don't believe it, but man, the guy's more like Reagan than just about any other president I can think of in history to compare him to. He just doesn't have the eloquence of delivery that Reagan had. Reagan was the kind of guy that could go out and give a speech, and a person that hated everything he was doing, so like, damn, I like the guy. Trump's the guy that if you go have a beer with him, well, he doesn't drink, right? But if you had a beer and he had a water, and you sat around and talked to him for 20 minutes, you come away liking the guy, even if you didn't. But if you don't like the guy and you listen to him give a speech, you completely hate him by the time he's done with it. It's just the way that it is. But that's what's actually in the big, beautiful bill. It's not all good. It's not all bad. And don't get too attached to any of it until we see what the Senate does with the dadgone thing. And the place I think that they most likely might give some stuff up is with the Hearing Protection Act, which is the silencers, the suppressors. And they shouldn't be called silencers, by the way. It's too much TV. Remember Mr. Miyagi in the original Karate Kid, you had too much TV, right? Like that. That's not how it works. That's not how. Now, if you're shooting 22 subsonics, okay, all right, yeah. But regular firearms, no, it's not how it works. All right, with that, we're going to go ahead and wrap things up. Remember, our item of the day today from Vivor is that badass stainless steel table with rolling casters on it. There's a million uses for it. It's totally worth checking out. If you haven't gotten a copy of my book, Laws of Life, yet, please do so. If you've gotten it, you've read it, and you haven't written me a review on Amazon yet, please do so. With that, it's been Jack Spirico with another edition of the Survival Podcast.
They said you should have a house the American way. Dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.